Thanks, Steve. Hello, everyone. Mitchell Rosenberg here. We fully recognize this is just before lunch, so if we don't go the full 60 minutes, we're happy to give that back to everyone. But excited to have this panel. Obviously, a lot of discussions generally in terms of cap bonds and the growth there, which has been exceptional. Cyber, which has been exceptional in the market as well, but a large portion of the market as a whole, and maybe a broader topic in terms of collateralized RE, collateralized retro. So we have a fantastic panel here. To my left, Laura Taylor, President, Nephila Holdings, Chris McEwen, Chief Executive, Reinsurance, ILS, and Innovation at Vantage Risk, and Paul Lorett, Chief Underwriting Officer at Securus Investments. So part of this session, we really want to talk about collateralized RE in general. Obviously, across the market, there's been a general theme of capital moving up, retrenching, whether collateralized, alternative, or balance sheet capital. And really, if that's an opportunity for those participating in the alternative capital space, collateralized RE in general, an opportunity to fill those gaps. So maybe with that, the kind of the first question to Chris is, does that present an opportunity, the opportunity to fill some of these gaps in the market?
Thanks, Mitchell. Thanks to Steve and Artemis for putting on this this event. 25 years now, Steve was saying last night that Artemis has been in business, so congratulations, Steve. And thanks again, Mitchell, for calling it collateralized capacity. I know we're going to get down to why it's called alternative reinsurance in a few minutes, so stay tuned for that. But I'll avoid the nomenclature for now. I mean, for us, you know, the retrenchment, people really focus on the pricing and the adjustment in retentions in the property cat space. And that certainly has happened. But we started our journey to bring in more capital to the market before Hurricane Ian. We saw demand ever increasing, and a demand-driven opportunity was presenting itself. And really, in talking to a lot of large personal lines carriers in the United States, where they would show you the trajectory, you know, yes, climate change, but demographics, inflation, and just the sort of the relentless, still 1,000, you know, housing starts in Florida every week or something like that. So there's demand that we need to acknowledge and bring more capital to bear. So we started doing that, and along the way, obviously Ian restructured and dislocated and restructured the market at 1/1/23. Digesting that was painful. It was a shock to a lot of reinsurance buyers. So there was an immediate opportunity in that retrenchment to step in with significant collateralized capacity. But at the same time, taking advantage of what now we might consider more appropriate pricing for the risk and a more appropriate level of retention for at least for mainline perils, we also thought we could accomplish a couple other things, which is being more clear, more clarity around coverage. I know on this panel there are advocates for this, but the perpetual promise to pay all perils product has got some issues with it. And to be more clear about what perils the buyer needs coverage for, whether that's hurricane, earthquake, I'm not excluding any, convective storm, but to be able to analyze those perils and understand them and provide that contract, because it is absolute capital that sits in a trust account for that peril. The second thing is that, and it's been talked about, I know, for maybe a few years now on this panel, is the capital management. I'd say that we got a sort of a bad mark from investors over the years for sort of the revisionist history would be lack of discipline around capital management / read collateral management. That this business is very hard to extract the collateral and see an ROC for your business when you need to hold on to it and it's trapped, and it's the inertia of getting that capital out and the discipline around P&L management. We also addressed that somewhat. We had some success on both fronts, in terms of perils and introducing some structural elements to incentivize the counterparty to actually release the collateral. The cat bond market certainly has that technology, and there's no reason why the reinsurance market can't either. You can't have it if you are selling a perpetual promise to pay that you now then have to have a balance sheet with a financial strength rating to provide that surety of coverage until the claim is eventually settled. But in the collateralized space, you know, we need that capital back. We need to explain that. And going into the market last year was a good example. We were a new entrant. We were able to achieve some structural sort of incentives and provide some element of relief for investors because that was a key element of investors' dissatisfaction or hesitation in our business. So returns are great. Level of attachment, level of where we sit in the risk, has been part of that retrenchment. But also some of these mechanical issues have also been addressed, and we should continue to be addressed.
Chris, you mentioned attractive time in the market. So maybe, Paul, just curiosity, as you talk to investors, is there a reason why more capital's not necessarily coming into the system when it is perhaps an attractive market? Are there still some things that need to be solved from your perspective for end investors?
Yeah, I think Securus, like many others, have found it easier to raise capital in the cat bond space and harder in the collateralized re and retro space. We're not alone in that. Investors look at the previous 3 to 5 year track record. That's not pretty with 2017 and 18. They saw loss drift from events like Irma and Ian. Ian's obviously moved in the right direction. And we see there are some headwinds, but the pricing environment is still attractive. There are signs of pressure there. But I don't think, in answer to the question, is I don't think we should revert to we being a collateralized vehicle offering coverage at a level whereby, let's say, the attachment probability is greater than 10 or 15%. I think the different participants in the market have strengths and weaknesses and are suited to different parts of that risk spectrum. We are seeing some investors gaining confidence in the new retention levels. They like the narrowing of the scope of cover to peak perils. We can talk about SCS later on, but investors like that cleaner product. And even in the private areas, we see we offer lower risk and higher risk products. And a lot of the money that's coming into the private side is kind of mirroring sort of cat bond risk profiles.
And anything, obviously the last several years, perhaps not 23 in particular, but prior, have been a lot of loss activity, whether on the frequency side or on the cat side. Has the reporting become, is it an issue, an opportunity for further growth or transparency in the system?
Yeah, I mean, Bernard mentioned transparency earlier. It's key for investors to have that transparency. On the loss reporting side, I think the market's come some way in improving sort of collateral release mechanisms. Obviously, trapped capital is a bad thing for an investor, suppressing IRs. We've developed on our collateralized re and retro products a wording that deals with essentially extension spreads. So our investors get paid about 3.5% per annum on this floating rate for any trapped capital during the risk period and afterwards. I think that kind of getting paid for that trapped capital will hopefully help in raising more capital into that space. I would say though that above about a 15% attachment probability is just not the area that we would play in, and I don't think it's ideally suited for any kind of collateralized product.
And on the collateralization, maybe Laura, just obviously a lot of discussion around value of collateral just in recent months generally across the industry. Just curious your perspective and from the panelists here, the value of collateral in the system as a whole.
I think the non-equity capital, collateralized, non-collateralized, whatever it might be, it is performing, it is providing its value. It's absorbing volatility and it's securing the severity events where it doesn't make sense to, like the volatility, equity capital doesn't want to absorb that from the indicators, and it's collateralizing the securitizing the out of the money risk where it's uneconomical to keep equity for those types of risks. So I think it's doing what it sets out to do, but really the retraction of capital from the market, we should be asking what value is the market providing to investors? And I think that's a lot of what we were saying here, where the opaqueness and the complexity of the asset class is demanding a novelty premium right now that even still isn't attracting capital, whether that's from liquidity challenges that some have faced over the past few years, surprises from prior events, but really the opportunity in front of those who work in the non-equity capital space is how do we bridge that gap, right? How, like, part of it is price, and then part of it is absolutely retentions, alignment of interests with the insurers, clarity of coverage, because really the preference around defined perils and things is because you can't assess price adequacy, right? So if they can't assess price efficiency, how can they allocate to the asset class? And how can they evaluate the asset class against other asset classes, right? We heard Evelyn and Bernard speak to that. This is a very small part of a lot of portfolios. If you don't understand it, you can make your money elsewhere.
Which I think is a good point. I'm curious kind of the group's thoughts here, where maybe others suspect there's aversion to certain perils, and maybe still the case, but in reality, it's more the precision or specificity in terms of what perils are covered, what they're covered. Is that a fair assessment, or
I think
middle ground?
I think we focused on, you know, insurance company retentions, cat bonds, reinsurance, retro. I think we've got to start at the very bottom of the risk and look at the insured. How much, you know, deductibles have improved, but I still think they've got caught out with inflation. And insurance to value is still a big issue. And although insurance companies are trying very hard to address it and using tools to do so, there's a bit of a catch-up process there. And then the actual risks themselves, the homes, the commercial buildings, they need to be hardened. And every dollar you spend on risk management at the location level of an individual insured building, it's got, you know, repercussions through the rest of the risk transfer chain. And I think more focus needs to go on just hardening roofs, you know, to SCS, for example, and improving the subject matter that we're all dealing with.
Interesting. You compared the product to equity, and I think that's an appropriate sort of way to frame the conversation. The equity capital that is provided to the industry generally is levered capital. It enjoys a financial strength rating. It's monitored by third parties, and it allows a balance sheet to write a diversified portfolio of business. So I think oftentimes when we talk about how much capital is allocated to this space, property cat, for instance, we don't really know. The individual reinsurance companies around the world manage and allocate that capital according to what they see, where they see opportunities. And there are draws on that capital away from property cat, into property cat. And to Laura's point, it up to a certain point, it's the most appropriate way to manage the risk, but it has limitations. And that's where I think collateralized, you know, reinsurance can come in somewhere between, and Paul and I will have a good, robust discussion over whether it's 15% expected value or higher or lower, but I think there are ways to provide that mezzanine, you know, equity-like but not equity protection and capital. I think one other thing, I'll get on my drum beat out of the way, is that there's very little, you know, product development in our business. And the reinsurance, it's hard to do, it's a derivative business, I understand that, but what Paul points to I think is important, which is the product development on the insurance side needs to, and it is, it's happening out of pain, and there's still a lot of pain in the system, but you see homeowners business moving from admitted to non-admitted, you see reciprocals starting up, different capital structures, so there is innovation going on at the primary level, and products and deductibles and things of that nature, and that needs to, you know, can flow through the system, so to speak. If you're a three-state mutual insurance company in the United States, you're not feeling very good right now. There's that pain still has to come through, I think, the system, and it'll create opportunities for us, but it'll mean, you know, some retrenchment, further retrenchment, I think, in the marketplace.
I think part of that increase in insurance company retentions and the pain they're suffering is that when you have like 10% inflation, and you can talk about aggregate covers earlier on, that the expected loss to an aggregate cover doesn't go up by 10% if the underlying vote inflation and values go up by 10%, right? It's normally a non-linear exercise. And so, you know, those layers that were paying 30 online now to be like 45 online with the 10% increase in exposures, right? So it's just too much risk going into those lower layers. And I think it takes time for the original primary carriers to raise their rates because of the regulations, but they're gradually getting there. And I just worry about any ILS funds getting back into sort of aggregate covers, and if you do that, you should always do a sensitivity analysis to see what, you know, what assumptions you change them by a small amount, and the expected losses, you know, go through the roof. So I think, yeah, we've tread very carefully in that area, even if there's innovation.
Yeah, I mean, I think right now we're in a point where the capital, you know, even talking about softening of rate or softening of terms and conditions, it's not time yet, right? We need consistent returns coming through to the asset class in order to demonstrate the long-term viability and profitability of the asset class. But it's also not binary, you know, in terms of like things. Right now, clarity is necessary because we've had surprises, right? So people are drawing back and moving up because of the noise and surprise and lack of confidence that there was sufficient pricing. But there is a price, right? So there's like the worldwide, I mean, God help, I don't want to go back to that, but worldwide retro, you know, ag product to the only the named perils product today. Right now, the named perils product is demanding the rate of a worldwide, you know, retro ag product because of that uncertainty and that lack of confidence. But there is a price for the worldwide retro ag, and there's a world where that, you know, makes sense, but it has to be sustainable and demonstrate that price sufficiency. So I think I would agree, we're in a world right now where very, very clear terms and conditions and very, very sufficient rate and novelty premium is where we're at today. But just like liquidity, right? Like liquidity can be priced. If you, the cap on market, I think it was Evelyn who mentioned, you know, I'm a little skeptical too, like it's liquid. Yes, there is an exit price and it may or may not be the bid on the sheets or the mid price. But, you know, we've seen with the balance sheets exiting the space and transferring books or buying ADC cover, there's an exit price for that as well. So same thing. So whether it's the terms and conditions or the liquidity profile, the role of fiduciary is to ensure that that is adequately priced and can be demonstrated to investors over the long term, and be, you know, move to wherever that best opportunity is and provide that best return with the investor risk and liquidity profile in mind.
Maybe kind of encapsulating all three, just from the end investor's perspective or some of your stakeholders. Have those changes in terms and conditions resonated in terms of also the price going up as well? So obviously two things have kind of buoyed the market in terms of becoming healthier, I think things said before, or is there still more work to be done? One, from an education standpoint, but two, still more work to be done from a product side?
I mean, some of it's probably just time, you know, I don't know. Just, you know, holding. Steady. I mean, we see, you know, the market's dislocated in all segments, some more than others. So you see, you know, some capital preferring to be in that top layer, sort of well-defined peril, which is fine. And then you have more opportunistic capital who maybe hasn't been in the market for the last 10 or so years coming into that bottom layer, mid layer, less defined, less strict capital. And the margins are meaningful, but they have to be in order to attract that capital in. So so probably, I mean, I think it's definitely more work to be done. As an industry, we have to do better. Because again, it's not just the investor. I mean, capital of all kinds has retracted. Balance sheets and non-balance sheets alike.
Yeah, I don't think we're anywhere near the right amount of capital to finance the risk that's out there. We can talk about undeveloped countries. We can talk about protection gap in this country, where we can argue, you know, hurricane is well financed or well risk managed, but wildfire, convective storm, winter weather, other events are, you know, the difference between the economic loss and the insured losses is pretty significant. And so that, you know, that alone, and get into the other thing, the inflation, as Paul mentioned, and climate shift, you know, there needs to be more capital brought in. So I don't think, I was reminded when you were talking, Laura, about that old Monty Python movie where I forget which one it is, but the strategy of the knights is to run away. Can't run away forever, gotta turn and face the risk. So I think you're right, we need to bring more forms of capital, more product to this marketplace to transform more risk into returns for investors on a predictable basis, as you say, Laura.
I think if you are gonna venture into, you know, higher frequency, higher attachment poverty layers, there's a world of difference between doing that on an all-risk basis, where you're exposed to all the black swan events, and you mentioned winter weather. The winter storm Uri in Texas is a good example of that. That's very different to maybe a frequency cover for just the peril of hurricane. So we've seen those where, you know, if you're going to go a little bit closer to risk, maybe just limit purely to hurricane, and you have a better understanding of that. And you're not exposed to all sort of the black swan events such as Uri, some of the wildfires, and so on.
I mean, the correlation of that, you know, that loss that year to, you know, or conditional probability of hurricanes in Texas that year should have been a concern for people selling all peril policy. It changed the landscape. Thankfully, there wasn't a direct hitting a hurricane, but it was, you know, the infrastructure was seriously compromised in the state of Texas that year.
I think it comes to kind of the requirement or value on specificity in terms of what's being covered at varying levels throughout the tower, and most efficiently matching capital and risk and where ultimately everyone wants to play. So on that, obviously, the collateralized market has been principally focused on property side of the business. Just maybe general thoughts from the group here in terms of other lines of business that might be suited for the capital that's supporting the collateralized market.
I'm the new guy. So
does that mean I go first?
There you go.
Right.
I'd rather see the property, for us personally, I'd rather see the property cat space grow. I think that's a sort of deep enough pool of exposure there to keep us busy at least, and try and, you know, develop the returns that we, you know, we're aiming for. Securus as a firm is not currently into cyber. I don't see that happening in the medium term or the short term, for some of the reasons that have been mentioned already. Casualty, likewise, I think that's an area that we're interested in, for all the reasons that have been previously discussed. We did look at space, relatively short tail line of business, which is a lot of work, given, you know, the allocation of that exposure to our portfolios was very modest. We felt that it just wasn't worth it, the time and effort involved in doing that. But that does have some of the characteristics that investors would like in terms of duration of exposures. Very, very transparent, you know, individual policy level, satellite level detail. But we decided to pull that, just given this, it's never going to be a big part of the portfolio, so you kind of, why bother?
I think what I was going to say, I there are others who have been at this longer than I have here, but the two sort of marketing pitches that you have for property cat, directionally non-correlating to your asset strategy and modeled clarity of coverage, we haven't scored well on that. I think directionally non-correlated, it scores very well. So, but we haven't convinced all the investors, to Paul's point, that we could come into this space, that is the case. So when you move to other lines of business that are more of a head scratcher in terms of correlation, longevity and the sort of intricacy of coverage is difficult. Having said that, when we started Vantage, it was the premise that we would hire best-in-class underwriters across all lines, and to the extent that we had partnership capital interested to hear more about our story and sit alongside of our private equity capital, you know, we are open to that. So we do get some inquiries in non-property cat. We have in the last year, just on the back of the Advantage success, to understand our specialty business, even our some of our excess casualty cyber business, and is there an ability to partner with us alongside the balance sheet? And you know, we're open to those discussions and having them now.
I mean, similar. We're predominantly, we do have three strategies, but property cat being the main one. I think you're right. The one side of the coin is there with new and emerging risks is the modeled and well understood and non-correlated. Obviously, the thesis behind property cat in the first place. But then on the other side is there a need, right? And that comes back to why did collateralized cover, the first cat bond, get issued? So is there a need for this type of capital to support it, which comes down to volatility and severity? So, you know, there definitely are emerging risks in sort of the net zero space, or probably cyber and others, where those two, or four, I guess, you know, premises hold. Whether that means Nephila is the manager or not, I don't know, but I think there's absolutely opportunity for collateralized type cover in that space. But it might be a different kind of capital as well. you know, I think pension funds, there were a few early adopters, but there wasn't really a large allocation of pension funds on a direct basis until post-credit crisis. If you look back for the first 10 years, maybe even longer, 15, of ILS, they were sort of more opportunistic, you know, hedge funds, multi-strats, fund-of-funds who were allocating to the space and were able to help it grow and create a track record and create an industry that then grew more broad for capital. So maybe there's a match there, but yeah, absolutely, there's opportunity. But there needs to be a need, right? Just adding more capital to casualty, that fits nicely on a rated balance sheet. Why would you, you know, I mean, again, on the around the little bit around the bit, but it's not gonna be a main driver.
And it seems evident that there is the need, or somewhat of a need, in the property cat side of the business for collateralized protection to come in, and you've kind of seen the composition of the reinsurance capital pool grow, and certainly a proportion of that being grown from alternative capital. So maybe a question I know we all kind of joked about, but as that proportion of the reinsurance capital becomes more predominantly alternative capital, should it still be called alternative capital? Is there a reason it still is, or how can we think about that as, from your perspective? Chris, over to you.
Thanks. Alternative sounds cool. But it's alternative
nothing
because
cooler than insurance, yeah.
What's that?
Nothing cooler than insurance.
It's being shoehorned generally into a different product. The balance sheet product, it's a great product, but I said before, it's a promise to pay product. It's got a certain nature of how it's managed. Most companies are either publicly traded or they're privately traded, but they're again operating on the back of a rating that tells them how to allocate the capital. And so that you know the idea that there's an alternative to that is easy to sort of to say that. I don't think collateralized reinsurance fits into the product, the process, or the coverage issues that we were talking about and the discipline. And I've been thinking about process a lot lately. A lot's been talk about defining perils and things. A reinsurance contract is heavily syndicated, usually placed within days or weeks of in the month of December, as we all know. A cat bond process is months. Somewhere, collateralized reinsurance should not be relegated to a process that requires three weeks of underwriting and due diligence. And we're new, so we don't have the operational clout maybe the other more mature carriers or collateralized carriers have. But it's not insignificant to get the collateral in the trust account, agree to documents, and execute within the matter of days. So I think we need to think about it in a different fashion than just it's an alternative to a traditional sense. So I use absolute capital. It's to Paul's point. You have to have it has to be there at the front of the contract for the entirety of the contract, and it performs its function for the coverages. We can debate which perils should be covered, but in going through some traditional covers, I was reading the list. I won't read the whole list of all the perils that are covered because it's extensive.
It's a very extensive list.
It's a very extensive list, and I've been in this business a long time and. Objects of extraterrestrial origin. I don't exactly know what that. I can't quite picture that, except for the Hollywood. And hill fire is a peril that I'd like to ask all the experts in the room to define for me. But it's a long list, and that's alternative. You want to talk about alternative, covering the alien invasion? Something I'd prefer not to do.
I think it's largely semantics. And if you sort of press for an answer, I think somewhere in that risk transfer chain, if it's a trust account balance with a trust bank, you could call that alternative. Because if you do bonds, it's pretty clear. If you do collateralized re and retro, it's pretty clear. We like yourselves probably do sort of sidecar slash collateralized quota shares, and obviously you're borrowing the balance sheet of the rated carrier, but still behind that is a trust account supporting to a PML, a TVAR value or something. So I think all forms of alternative, ultimately, somewhere in that risk transfer chain is a trust account balance.
I mean, I'm confused as you are by the name. one way, I was thinking the question, trying to simplify it. There's equity and non-equity capital. And we know what equity capital is. So what is non-equity capital? I mean, it could be debt, It could be even reinsurance itself, which is, regardless of who the parties who are trading with each other are, that really is a form of capital management. It could be collateralized, it could be fronted, it could be a sidecar, it could be, I mean, I think it's just equity or non-equity in the most simplest terms. But
no less valuable than the other.
No less. I mean, they complement each other well. Yeah. Exactly. And even within the capital itself has different sources, different expectations, different. You know, it doesn't. Non-equity capital is a very, very large category.
And you've certainly seen this non-equity pool of capital, however we want to categorize it, take on larger proportions of the overall pie. So maybe just forward-looking, what does that composition look like from your perspective? Is it 50-50? Is it remain constant where we are? Does it fill different needs, lines of business?
Probably depends on how the market performs, but I think the indications from the market we're getting right now is the balance sheets, the equity capital, have a very low tolerance for volatility. And we know they're constrained on the severity, right? Because again, you just have rating agency constraints and things where that keeping that equity capital doesn't make sense. The required rate of return is too high. So we see on the other side, you see the demand for with population growth, inflation, development, that the demand is going up. So I would probably, I mean, I'm probably biased, but I would say, you know, given the indications from the balance sheets, that I would see more growth on the non-equity capital side. Now, if the market performs well, and even if we have events and the track record remains strong, you could see the balance sheets maybe saying, well, maybe this is a space we want to get back into. But given they've just pulled out, I'm not sure that that's within a 12-month span.
Yeah, no, I agree. The demand, sorry, Paul. The demand trajectories that I've seen outstrip the potential compounded growth of the equity capital in our business for the next 20 years. So and then this question of what does that, as Laura says, what is that equity capital going to do with its capital? It's going to be a function of the sum total of smart people running reinsurance companies making decisions around allocating to emerging risk, intellectual property, cyber, other lines that may have a better return profile for their investors than the volatility that comes with the property cat. So I think it really is a function of that. And but I don't see any reason why it wouldn't continue to grow in absolute terms.
I think I see steady growth in the cat bond market. I do see investors demanding better liquidity in terms of more frequent liquidity, which obviously means more opportunities to trade in and out. So I think the pricing will be more sensitive. I don't think they're going to, you know, have like semi-annual liquidity if it's quarterly liquidity or even shorter. And also the UCITS funds would be much shorter than that. That higher liquidity is going to generate a more sensitive market. So I do see some capital pulling back if pricing deteriorates too quickly. But I think a general trajectory of cat bond growth, I see that. Within the sort of ILW space, that's a very, very opportunistic market. Probably the fastest to react in both directions. I see that being stable, not really growing. The area I see there's some growth has been, which I mentioned before, is parametric, particularly for some of these sort of World Bank, growth areas. So I see parametric growing quite materially over the next sort of decade. But and then the collateralized and retro, I think it's probably going to stay fairly stable.
And if I kind of flip the question in terms of how the market grows, where it is currently, maybe from an insurance or reinsurance buying retro, but from the buyer's perspective, when they're looking at equity capital and take the points, it's a different form, it's a different product, et cetera. What is holding back their decision from your perspective in terms of transacting or trading with collateralized capacity? Is it, and Chris, to your point, process, things like this, but maybe just thoughts around how that market can grow or what can be done or thought of differently from the buyer's perspective?
I think it still needs to be demystified. It's dubbed often alternative, opportunistic. We've used all those words. It really is it here for the long haul, right? And reinsurance business puts a high value on renewability. I think that needs to be explained a little bit better. That if the returns are there, we've all been saying this. If the returns are there, the capital will come. I think you can look at valuations across
the publicly traded carriers and come to a conclusion that it's not necessarily the best investment at the moment. So I think we need to show returns, show knowledge of the risks that we're underwriting, and expectation of not relying on models that might be historical or stochastically, but using the power of data and technology and maybe even generative AI to say, you know, what does a predictive view of this risk look like? I think you gain a lot of investor confidence with those types of movements that are happening in the industry to bring them and keep them into what is a purposeful industry. It's an essential industry for the economy.
I think it'd be interesting to see how investors, those that lean on sort of previous trailing 3-year, 5-year returns, performance, obviously critical to success. But if you're always investing after 5 clean years of clean, you're always by definition going to be investing into a softer market. So as investors get more comfortable with this asset class, maybe the modeling gets more scientific, better control of exposures and risk management, maybe they'll look at the absolute level, premium levels, and invest at those times slightly quicker, rather than coming in sort of 5 years, 3 years down the line, when almost by definition it'll be a softer market.
And hopefully, to your point earlier, that's going through the value chain on the insured, which is making it an overall healthier market for investors at the end of the day. Maybe with 23 minutes left before lunch, open up the questions to the audience if there's any questions for the panelists here.
Oh, yeah. Hey, Jack Stone with Gallagher. I had a couple questions around returns. So do you guys keep track of actual historical return from an IRR perspective on the collateralized placements when accounting for the trapped collateral net of the fees? And then how do you disclose that past performance when you're marketing the fund to new investors? And then how do your model returns account for those scenarios, given the model IRR is probably pretty sensitive to when you fund and when you redeem?
I'll take the first of those questions, maybe. In terms of IRRs, we do use them. In our pricing tool, every event is timestamped, and we before the contract commences, we put in the buffer loss table mechanism, so we can explicitly model the cash flows over time based on the date of loss of each event, each stochastic event. When that happens in the catalog, how many months it takes to settle the claim, and then it refers to the contractual buffer loss table to work out when the cash flows will take place. So that is something we do look at, and that's also why we have on the collateralized product, the extension spreads that we use to help improve that IAR. That's your first question, I think.
Yeah. I mean, yes, yeah. We work with every investor has their own preference on how they want to evaluate the asset class. So absolutely, we have worked with those if they considering the illiquidity or the exit component, and then that will drive how much more return they require to allocate to the space.
So to Chris's point then about, I don't want to use AI as a buzzword because it just gets thrown around, but what are you guys doing at the fund level, maybe on the reinsurer side, to kind of account for all these various scenarios and that sensitivity of, I guess my point is when you actually consider the trapped collateral, it can't be put to use, and there's other investment opportunities in the whole universe of investments. How are you conveying that to the third party capital, and how is that coming through in the pitch decks, and what do those conversations look like? And I guess, and how do you see the current technology is being able to help kind of model and account for those scenarios?
You want me to go? Yeah. I think you've hit sort of the nail on the head there, and every manager addresses it in their own way, and it would be proprietary. But I think you're spot on in terms of one of the key blockers to new capital coming in, and some managers have better ways to address that than others. So I can't answer it, on a panel, but happy to talk to you directly.
Maybe a derivative question of that, just thinking about the full value chain, is are you getting the right information from your counterparties to be able to convey to your investors what your returns, expectations, and things like that? So it goes back to Paul, the loss reporting and things like this, but are we getting the right information? Is it being shared in a timely fashion? Because I assume there's still more work to be done on that perspective.
I think technology plays a part. We're getting to the point where we can share more data with investors in a consistent way. Just going back to the reinsurance and dealing with past losses, we do most of our reinsurance fronted. All our retro is collateralized, but the reinsurance is mostly fronted with two fronting partners. And in those contracts, there's actually an explicit 3-year commutation provision in it. So we'll get to an independent actuarial review of the reserves after 3 years, after the end of the risk period, of each cohort of transactions. And we can either agree or not agree to those reserves. And if we don't agree, it goes to 4 years. But it's important there's an embedded contractual commutation provisions in all those contracts.
Any other questions from the audience?
Talked a bit about not. I'm Phil Rosacci from Vantage. I think I heard you all talk a bit.
It's not a plan.
I don't know what Phil's
going to ask.
It's not going to be a softball.
It's going to be a hard one.
Exactly. you all spoke about non-property cat lines being put into collateralized reinsurance. So, like, what are some of the challenges that come with that from a collateralized free perspective? Like, what that property, it's not challenging for property, but would be for some of these other specialty lines.
Go ahead, sorry. Suppression of, you mentioned, I think the previous discussion about casualty was pretty much spot on, right? So 5-year duration of liabilities does not really lend itself to a collateralized product. And as you said, Nora, like, it's probably currently adequate supply of capital to that casualty portfolio already, so it's not really an area where there's a shortage of demand, of supply of capital. But when we looked at crop business, and frankly, that has got some of the right characteristics for ILS, just that we felt that the margins were too thin. And sometimes we're battling against traditional reinsurers of balance sheets that when they roll up that portfolio, sort of their the marginal capital allocation process means that they allocate very little capital to those things like crop. And so you can't compete with them because their return on equity is so strong because they're allocating so little capital to that line of business, whereas we can't do that. Unless we sit behind a balance sheet, we can't compete with that sort of cap allocation.
Yeah, and it's probably sort of more of a broader challenge for the industry as a whole, collateralized or non-collateralized. So it's more the newer spaces have less track record. The underwriting approach, no matter how robust, there's still some unknowns there. So when you're, again, if you're a balance sheet and you can carve off a small portion of that to kind of invest in that stream and start to build that track record and start to build that underwriting approach, it could be that at a time when it grows to a point where there is something to evaluate and look at, that then collateralized capacity could come in to complement it. If there is a need, again, volatility, severity, if it's like highly predictable returns, or just balance sheets can handle that just fine. Yeah.
Sometimes you find that you get a lot of loss data and a lot of exposure data, but what you don't get them is coupled exposure loss data, right? So to build the models to satisfy our pricing and to satisfy our investors, you need to have the associated exposures with those claims. And some of these sort of specialty lines of business, you don't get that data where you can relate a given claim to a given exposure to build a sophisticated model.
I think sustainability is also part of the issue, is that we've talked about demand, and you know, we all see more demand in the property cat space. It's more cyclical in some of these smaller lines of business for the reasons that Paul mentioned. So I think investors like to know if they're going to allocate. I think to spend the time and you know, to invest the time and effort to writing a memo and going to the investment committee and making it a part of their portfolio. They want to know sort of what that looks like going forward. It's harder to honestly, it's harder to say given the flexibility of the balance sheet equity that can you know, consume that quickly with you know, with less capital if they decide to you know, to do so and marginally allocate less. So it's not as a predictable sort of path to sustainable growth, I think.
I think to your earlier point, though, the insurance gap is widening in property cat and then new and emerging risks as well. So yeah, I'm very optimistic. There's lots of opportunity down the road. I just you know don't know which one or where.
And I think you all touched on it before, which is one of the principal theses of the ILS market or insurance has been the diversification that it provides. And if you think about the property cat, that's certainly been why a lot of investors have you know, found the property cat to be interesting. And it's clear there's still sufficient opportunity in the property side of the business. Any other questions from the audience or everyone's hungry for lunch here?
Lunch it
is. Perfect. Lunch it is. Thank you all for the time. It was a great discussion.